There were anti-war and civil rights demonstrations all over the country in 1966, and that summer James Meredith began what he called a march against fear through Mississippi to encourage African Americans to register to vote. But local politicians had a plan to handle the situation, make promises, and provide no pretext or reason for continued protest, and assume, as they said, that the local Negroes will stay in their place. As John McEachin, the city manager of Grenada, Mississippi, explained to a reporter, quote, "All we want is to get these people through town and out of here. Good niggers don't want anything to do with this march, and there are more good niggers than sorry niggers." And then James Meredith was shot. The latest book from Aram Gutsuzian, the chair of the history department at the University of Memphis, is Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. It's published by Farrah Straus and Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Professor Gutsuzian to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
So James Meredith became famous because he sued to be admitted into the University of Mississippi?
Yeah. So James Meredith in 1962 basically prompted a constitutional crisis by applying to the University of Mississippi, what was known as Ole Miss, and then going through the legal process to be admitted. And that prompted this great federal crisis that led to riots and so on.
He said that he had been inspired by President Kennedy's inaugural address.
And Meredith that the NAACP worked with him to successfully be able to enter Ole Miss.
Mm-hmm. And on October 1st, 1962, he became the first African American at Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. Was the country paying attention to this?
Absolutely. In this, the question of Meredith's admission into Ole Miss and what would happen was something that was stirred especially by Mississippi politicians, particularly the governor, Ross Barnett, and led to outsiders coming into Mississippi, in particular white supremacists, violent white supremacists from all around the country, that Ole Miss sort of became a standing ground for segregationists.
Mm-hmm. So what was his time at Ole Miss like? He only went 1 year, didn't he?
Yeah, did he graduate? He graduated, yes.
He had
accumulated credits at Jackson State University and elsewhere. So he only needed one more year to graduate. So he graduated in the summer of 1963. But after these riots that occurred, after two people died amidst those riots, and after a year of incredible isolation. He had to be protected by federal officials throughout his time in Mississippi, throughout his time at Ole Miss. So that really shaped him too. He would always consider himself set apart and special, but now he had become increasingly isolated.
Mm-hmm. He got his law degree at Columbia University, mm-hmm. far from Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. By 1964, only 6.7% of voting age African Americans were registered to vote in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. How did that compare with other parts of the South?
In other parts of the South, you see much higher percentages even prior to the passage of the Voting Rights Act, you know, somewhere in the range of 20%, 30% typically in most deep Southern states.
And that's because of the Voting Rights Act, but
this is prior to the Voting Rights Act even, that there were some numbers of blacks who were registered to vote. In Mississippi, practically none.
So 65 changed things, and
absolutely.
Mississippi was the most resistant state still.
Certainly. So by the time of Meredith's march in 1966, the focus of my book, the percentage of registered voters is somewhere up around 30%.
And James Meredith held a press conference to announce that he'd march from Memphis, where you teach, mm-hmm. to Jackson, Mississippi. Was this promoted and supported by other leaders in the civil rights movement?
No, not at all. It was very much the work of one solitary man, James Meredith. He envisioned this march himself. He didn't really seek support from outside groups. He didn't want a mass march on the order of, say, the Selma march the previous year. He was very much an individual.
And he didn't get one. He only had five men, including himself, when the march began.
Absolutely. And that was kind of the way he wanted it. He wanted only men. And he wanted people who were independent and could take care of themselves and people who wouldn't impose on the local communities that they passed through.
Also people, I assume, who he felt would be able to put up with the kind of harassment that they were going to experience, perhaps violence.
Absolutely.
They'd already seen violence at Selma.
And his stated goal was that this was a walk against fear. So it was to, A, encourage voter registration among black Mississippians, but, B, to try to conquer what he saw as a culture of fear, this culture of intimidation that kept black people from trying to achieve equal rights.
Was he one of the people who believed in nonviolence as a tactic?
No, no. Meredith would never have considered himself nonviolent in the vein of Martin Luther King. In fact, he was quite a prominent critic of it for a number of reasons. One was that he thought it exposed particularly women and children to violence. Second was that he believed, like many other African Americans at the time, that if you wanted to achieve genuine equality, if you wanted to achieve genuine respect, then you had to put yourself on equal terms and you had to assert your right to self-defense.
He didn't even agree with the term civil rights movement.
He really didn't see himself as part of a civil rights movement per se. Absolutely. He always had difficulty connecting to a larger mass experience.
So what was the goal here if he didn't believe he was part of the civil rights movement? He was trying to register voters. That was a major goal of the civil rights movement.
Yes, he is part of the civil rights movement. And of course, you know, the Ole Miss crisis was an important flashpoint of the civil rights movement. And then this march ultimately will become another classic story in the civil rights movement. And his goals do dovetail with it. But he didn't see himself as part of a larger movement.
And do you think that it would have had the kind of impact it had if he hadn't been shot just right after he'd crossed the state line?
Certainly
in Mississippi?
Not. The shooting of James Meredith on the second day of the march, it's when he's just gone through his first town in Mississippi on Highway 51, Hernando, Mississippi. That absolutely transforms his march from really the work of a singular individual into a civil rights extravaganza.
And the first reports were that he was killed. Mm-hmm. How badly was he injured?
He was shot by birdshot, and he was shot three times. His attacker discharged three shots, and he had a number of pellets lodged inside his body. He was somewhere between 60 and 80 pellets, birdshot pellets were lodged inside his body. So he was severely wounded, but he was not killed.
In Mississippi.
Even in Mississippi, it became front page news. But it was portrayed in a very different way. The shooting was in the Deep South, got a very different reception. They blamed Meredith. He was a guy who they said strolled into a lion's den. He should have known what was coming. It was sort of a backwards argument, if you ask me.
In fact, you're right. The Jackson papers panned to White's worst instincts. They portrayed the marchers As outside agitators,
as hailing from the North, where there were deeper problems of race than there were in the South, as they saw it. And they blamed the shooting even on a conspiracy, because the man who shot James Meredith was a guy named Aubrey Norville. He was a man from Memphis, Tennessee, and he had no known connection to any white supremacist organization. His motives for shooting Meredith were a mystery at the time and remain a mystery. He lives today and still refuses to admit his motives. So for most of the country, they saw him perhaps as a typical racist Southerner. For some, they said, this was a conspiracy in line with the Mississippi police. They had helped to let this guy do it. But for many segregationists of the time, they said this is a conspiracy perpetrated by civil rights activists. They paid someone to shoot James Meredith, wound him, and then so it will turn into a big to-do. Now, there wasn't much logic to that argument, but it was
we've heard that argument before, we still do when similar things happen.
Yeah, it was a key sort of psychological reassurance against this new descent of federal officials and national media into Mississippi, along with the Martin Luther Kings and the Stokely Carmichaels.
And the shooting brought civil rights leaders and the Big Five organizations to Mississippi, including Martin Luther King
Absolutely,
Jr.,
Stokely
Carmichael, Floyd McKissick. They all led different organizations with differing views on how to fight for civil rights. Was there a consensus on how they would continue the march?
No. By 1966, you've got civil rights organizations that have always, had different focuses and different agendas. But by 66, they're finding it increasingly difficult to work together. In fact, among those civil rights leaders that you mentioned who came to Memphis to determine to carry on the march was Roy Wilkins of the NAACP. Now, the NAACP is the most established, most longstanding, most well-funded of the civil rights organizations, but it has primarily a legal approach and an orientation toward the government and toward broader the broader United States. For Stokely Carmichael and Snick, they saw NAACP as hopelessly old-fashioned, as not really concerned with what were the key issues of the civil rights movement, which was uplifting poor black people and putting them into positions of power. So they had very different ideas for the march. For the NAACP, this is a lobbying tool to the federal government. For SNCC, they see this as a chance to do more grassroots organizing.
My guest is Aram Gutsousian. His book, Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. I've read a report from Grenada, Mississippi, in which they tricked the people who wanted to register. But first, they tried to do everything possible to prevent them from doing it. But then they hired people to register them, black citizens, and they later fired. But also, they didn't tell them that they had to take a slip of paper to City Hall to really register. And so they simply it was just simply something to shut people up.
That kind of subterfuge was very typical of the types of sort of subtle resistance that that whites in power in the cities and counties of Mississippi were still using to try to keep blacks from registering to vote. The Voting Rights Act was supposed to protect black voter registration, and wherever there were federal registrars, the voting went through much more smoothly. What we see in these Mississippi towns is something quite different.
When you teach this in your as the chair of the history department at University of Memphis in the South, what kind of response do you get from students? Do you think it would be similar to what you might get if you were teaching it at NYU or Columbia?
In some ways, yes. I think for those students, they feel a strong, deep historical distance from the events of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, for African Americans, who make a large percentage of our students at the University of Memphis, they tend to admire the Civil Rights Movement and tend to see it as a touchstone. But even for white students who would fall into a more conservative spectrum, they still see the Civil Rights Movement as something good and as something that happened a long time ago. So they don't feel a direct connection to it.
Although the Confederate flag still becomes an issue in the South.
The same person who might have a Confederate flag on their truck can also see the Civil Rights Movement as something good.
You write that Martin Luther King gave the March Against Fear a moral authority. How did his presence mark a larger national response?
Yeah, King was the central figure in the March Against Fear, and without his participation, it would not have become the endeavor that it did. He is important on the ground in the sense that wherever Martin Luther King travels, people flock to see him. So that, you know, your average local black Mississippian, they wanted to come to the march. They wanted to see Martin Luther King, to literally touch the hem of his garment, to give him a glass of water, to feed him an apple, to hear him speak. And to hear him, his speeches in the midst of the marching, he has this powerful moral authority that, you know, we've come to associate with Martin Luther King. But he's doing so much. He's trying to balance the impulses of the black militants with the agenda of the NAACP. He's trying to welcome the white marchers as well as the black marchers, and he has these incredible, as everyone knows, these incredible rhetorical gifts. But King's presence also guarantees that there's going to be national media, that it's going to get all sorts of attention, and perhaps even draw the attention of the federal government.
And people from rural areas traveling to be part of this. A manifesto was released to the press. What did it say, and what was James Meredith's – he's in the hospital at this point, right? Recovering. What was his reaction?
For Meredith, they asked him to sign the manifesto as sort of a sponsor of the march along with the participating civil rights organizations, and he refused to sign it. He didn't have a problem with its message per se. He wasn't going to sign a manifesto that involved any civil rights organization or any other group. You know, for him, this was his walk. It was his message, and it had been co-opted. So on one hand, he gave the march his blessing because he understood that it had to continue. But on the other hand, he was continually frustrated throughout those 3 weeks that it had drifted from his original vision of the march.
And you're right that Meredith was trapped in the role of victim hero.
Which is a role he hated to be considered a victim. And it frustrated him that he had been shot. And he wished that he had brought a gun on the march because he said, he shot me like a goddamn rabbit, he said. If I'd had a gun, and that never would have happened. You know?
Now, in other marches like Selma, the police were part of the problem. But the marches were protected by law enforcement in Mississippi. Was this a strategy?
Absolutely. For the first, especially for the first 2.5 weeks of this 3-week march, they received fairly extravagant protection from the Mississippi Highway Patrol for most of that time. Mississippi Highway Patrol is the state police, and this was part of the strategy of the governor, Paul Johnson, that he saw the Highway Patrol as this professional force that he was developing, and that they would be essential to keeping the marches moving along, keeping peace, letting people register to vote in small numbers, and then just moving them along. Why? But, because he didn't want any more incidents. More incidents means more publicity, bad publicity for white Mississippi.
But that also meant keeping the Ku Klux Klan and the white citizens' councils under control.
Absolutely. So keeping white supremacists at bay was part of the job of the Highway Patrol. And they would warn the civil rights leaders. They were receiving reports. Among the sources that I had to tell the story were the surveillance reports by the Highway Patrol.
Mm-hmm. Now, just 10 days after the march began, mm-hmm. Stokely Carmichael of SNCC introduced the slogan Black Power. Did mm-hmm. that exacerbate the situation?
Black Power immediately became a force of controversy and a force of strength for the march. Controversy in the sense that immediately it launched, you know, in the media, the questions about what Black Power means, that this march was reflecting a new militancy in the civil rights movement, that it had brought these young militants to the fore, and they were shaping the movement in a way that made many liberals and made the press often very uncomfortable, right? Because they were less concerned with appealing to white America than a previous generation of activists. Black Power took those sentiments, the frustrations with the federal government, the frustrations with the slow pace of reform, the continued violence that they faced, but it also married that to a whole set of aspirations. Black pride, the sense that black people should control their own political destiny, their own communities. So it was both a cynical phrase, but also a very hopeful phrase, both alienating and unifying. So it became a very powerful slogan for capturing all these sentiments.
But unlike the Black Panthers, Carmichael neither endorsed nor denounced violence.
Yes, he was very careful in terms of he was constantly asked about violence. The press fixated on this issue of is Black Power violent? So they were always trying to pin down his feelings on it, and he kind of refused to answer the question. He was not someone who had called for violent revolution, certainly not in 1966. But he did assert a right to self-defense. So for him, the contrast to nonviolence wasn't violence. It was self-defense.
And then a week later, on June 23rd, mm-hmm. the Meredith Marches reached Kent in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a small town, 9,700 people. Mm-hmm. You describe it as a civil rights hotbed. Mm-hmm. What was the town's history?
So both SNCC, Carmichael's organization, and CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, had been organizing in Mississippi. There had been grassroots organizers there since the early 1960s. In most of Mississippi, it was SNCC organizers. In Canton, it was mostly CORE organizers. And they had come in the early 1960s. They'd tried to ally with local leaders, both sort of, you know, tough, straight-talking men and also sweet church women of various stripes. So they had a way of trying to connect all sorts of aspects of the community. And they'd been able to stage what were known as Freedom Days, which were voter registration drives. So Canton had this long history of grassroots organization. However, by 65, 66, some of that organization was starting to fall apart. So the Meredith March gave them an opportunity, like other local communities. It gave them a chance to sort of kickstart their local civil rights movements again.
But then the state police used tear gas against the protesters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
up until now, they've been protecting them.
Mm-hmm. The tear gassing in Canton, Mississippi, in the midst of the Meredith March, in the last week of the march, is in some ways one of the great forgotten stories of the civil rights movement. What had happened was previously in the march, the marchers had they'd always tried to camp. They'd try to set up their tents on land that was in the black community that was public and tax supported. They saw that as sort of an exercise of their citizenship. They were denied that in Canton, but they decided they were going to pitch the tents there anyway. And when they did so, the police first let them do it, and then the highway patrol showed up, donned their riot gear, and launched tear gas into the crowd of about 1,000 people at this point. And it was as brutal a scene as you can imagine.
And Martin Luther King suffered as a result, but in Canton and then in Philadelphia as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then they went to Jackson?
Yes.
How did the state capitol handle it?
Well, there was a compromise forged. The marchers wanted to end their march at the front steps of the state capitol. They saw this as sort of a dramatic backdrop and one that, of course, connects to the idea of political power. But for Mississippi's white authorities, they saw that as a grave insult for a couple reasons. One, you know, that's where they held governor inaugurations and so on. Also, there was a huge statue of a Confederate war memorial. And previously during the march, the marchers had put American flags on Confederate war memorials, which was considered a grave insult to many white Southerners at the time. And they'd even used guards to protect various war memorials. So they didn't want the march there. So they had compromised with what they had. the final rally on the backside of the Capitol building.
And then, 15,000 people showed up. Mm-hmm. That's not a huge crowd.
It's not a huge – it's the largest civil rights demonstration in Mississippi history. So it is – it's fairly significant. Now, King had envisioned something bigger. He envisioned something along the lines of the final rally in Montgomery, like as existed the previous year. But when you talk, but if you get that local perspective, if you talk to people from Mississippi and particularly people from Jackson at that time, this was a very important moment in civil rights history that's also been forgotten.
Well, has Mississippi changed all that much over the years? What percentage of African Americans are registered to vote or can be registered to vote?
That's a good question. I don't know the figure on that. Certainly, the number of black office holders has increased. The number of blacks on a local scale has increased. There's been a black congressman from Mississippi. Certainly, blacks are an element of political power within Mississippi. So you can point to, obviously, you can point to signs of progress since the civil rights movement. But if you want to look at sort of the larger statistical indicators, infant mortality, poverty, you name it, right? Mississippi still ranks near the bottom of all those indicators. And that is obviously connected to its tortured racial history.
Did Meredith consider his march a success?
I think he stopped considering it his march. The parts where he actually participated at the beginning and then he joined the march at the very end, he was happy with that. But the next year, he returned in 1967 to march the stretch that he never marched. And he walked about 160 miles during that time. And by doing so, he sort of felt like he fulfilled his own personal mission at that point.
Now, Memphis, your city, is much more successful in terms of race relations. Do you think it's a matter of geography?
It's partly a matter of geography. I mean, Memphis certainly has is plagued by racial division as well, and we continue to see that in our contemporary political issues, particularly around schools and particularly around poverty. So I wouldn't give Memphis a free pass in this regard. But Memphis had a different pattern of race relations because it had a larger black middle class that tended to negotiate with white businessmen and white politicians. Integration, at least at that first level, happened much more smoothly than it would in Mississippi. And in Memphis, because of longstanding political patterns, blacks had always had the right to vote, as long as they voted for the existing political machine in Memphis. That was not the case in Mississippi.
Aram Khatsouzian is chair of the History Department at the University of Memphis. He's the author of King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution, The Hurricane of 1938, Sidney Poitier, Man, Actor, Icon, and now the book we've been discussing, Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, thanks so much for having me.